Mr. Hitchcock, Reel 7, you were describing the scene on your arrival in the morning off Omaha Beach on the 7th of June, D+1.
Apart from the bangs and the flashes and the smoke of the beachhead and all the landing craft in the distance piling up there, the vision was good. The sea was possibly... Well, the wind would possibly be force 4 or force 5. It had subsided from the near gale that we had come in on when we'd gone to Swansea. And I was aware of a vast number of jellyfish swimming, floating past the ship as we moved along slowly. We were going quite slowly at this point. And then suddenly, in among this, I became aware of an enormous metallic bang. As I was looking at the ships that we had escorted all the way from Swansea in line ahead, I suddenly became aware that one had been hit by something. And a plume went virtually straight up into the sky. The bang was metallic, a strange sound. I'd never heard anything quite like it before. The Susan B. Anthony had been hit severely astern. We were not alongside, but only a few cables distant away alongside, so I could see this quite perfectly. The Susan B. Anthony was a big ship. It was a US naval ship. It was what they call a Liberty ship. And it was painted grey and had a large number of support troops aboard. There was a certain amount of confusion initially. Obviously, damage control had to find out what was the extent of the damage to the vessel. The other ships in line went on, but we were detailed to pull alongside on the starboard side of the Susan B. Anthony. This was quite an impressive business because she towered above us initially. After all, 1,800 tons isn't all that big. And the troops were lined up. The first orders were that the troops should get onto the upper deck, stand to, and bring their weapons with them. They were going to be taken off in an orderly fashion because it was anticipated that the Susan B. Anthony would be towed in, and a tug came alongside, which was Tug Pinto. Alongside the port side, there was another vessel, which was an L destroyer, which was the Mendip. That's a Hunt-class destroyer. And we were on the starboard side, hoping to prop it up. So the idea was that between us, the tug and Narborough, we would somehow manage to beach the Susan B. Anthony in shallow water when the men could be taken off in orderly fashion. So that plan failed. The Susan B. Anthony had been severely damaged. The watertight doors may not have been closed properly, I have no idea. But a good number of men astern were killed outright, and they were locked in. The ship began to settle. In all, it took some 2.5 hours to go down. Our role changed. It was to one of taking off survivors. Scrambling nets were thrown. These were the rough coir scrambling nets. And the orderly disembarkation changed to a reasonably orderly disembarkation down the scrambling nets onto Narborough. Ships on the other side, and I'm not exactly certain which ships these were because the tug must have gone, another captain class frigate, possibly Rupert, went alongside, and scrambling nets were again put down, but obviously I couldn't see what was going on, and the damage must have been on the starboard side because as time went on, the Susan B. Anthony, which was a big vessel, began to list towards us. And this was a little ominous. However, it did enable us to take off more than anyone else. Until eventually, although the official number is somewhat lower than I was told at the time, we were told that we'd taken well over 1,000 off the Susan B. Anthony. In all, I was told that some over 2,000 people were saved, 2,000 of the support group. We took off some high-ranking American officers. We took off a man by the name of General Williams. Rather unfortunate that General Williams, who was a logistics expert, had been in one of the last cock-ups, which occurred in the Sicily landings. This is where my young friend Thomas Metcalf comes in, because General Williams, I learnt later, had been in charge of providing the Dakotas and the gliders, some of which were American, for the Sicily landings. And as people well know, many landed in the sea, including Tommy Metcalf, which was a disaster for all and sundry. So the gliders didn't do well in Sicily. And here we have General Williams coming down from the Susan B. Anthony at the next major invasion. I don't know whether he went to Anzio, but he certainly had a problem because his ship was shot from under him off Omaha. He went on the bridge, was invited on the bridge by our skipper. After all, our skipper was in charge, and he was then making arrangements for the disembarkation of all his men. Another captain class frigate came alongside us because we were overloaded, we were overladen. And I took on the role of getting the men from the now fast disappearing Susan B. Anthony onto the other ship. I'm not quite sure which ship of our group was there. However, we had them jumping across. After all, it was still fairly rough, and we were banging up against the side of the Susan B. Anthony. The captain frigate was slapping up against our side, and men were jumping across as they came. I was directing this at one point, sending blokes across. In the middle of all this, a colonel, I discovered he was a ranger, came up to me, an American colonel, and said, "I want to see my general." So I said, "You can't see your general." He said, "Why not?" I said, "Because he's busy. His ship's just been shot from under him. He's making arrangements for all you people being disembarked. You can't go and see him now. What do you want to see him about?" I was a young, ordinary coder. He was an American colonel. He said, "Oh, shucks," he said, "when I think of those guys down below." It was a kind of an Errol Flynn motion to me. I always thought I was at the Flicks. And he said, "when I think about those guys down below, I'm mighty displeased." He said, "those poor chaps." He said, "I'll never get it from me." I said, "well, never mind." I said, "get your guys organized. Get them here. We'll get them aboard this other ship, or get them sorted out on our ship and we will take you." And his parting words to me, that was the last I saw of him, the parting words to me, "my, you English sailors are grand." He bore me no animosity. He could see I was busy. We pulled away from the Susan B. Anthony, the last ship to do this, and watched her disappear. By this time, smoke was issuing along with flame out of the funnel. It was going down by the stern, and the last rites were being performed. It rose out of the water, the bows stuck up, and with very little ceremony, the Susan B. Anthony disappeared rather like a dart going into the bull's eye, because ripples came out from the remnants of the Susan B. Anthony as she disappeared forever below the waters of Omaha. I presume she's still there as a war grave. This I don't know. We went in ashore with about 700 American troops. I didn't see a weapon amongst them. Another American officer came up to me and offered me a dagger. He also was a ranger. He got this huge knife and said, "Take this as a souvenir." And I refused to take it. I told him that it were far more use to me, to him than to me. He hadn't got a gun. I said, "Where's your gun?" And he said, "Oh, shucks," he said, "they got stacks of guns here. The Mackie's got it organized. They got jeeps, they got ammo, they got guns." By this time we'd come closer inshore. I said to him, "The only gun you'll get, mate, is from the guys who went in on the first waves and didn't make it." He didn't believe me. I have no idea what happened to him. I refused his dagger. I said, "At least it'll open you a can of beans and you won't starve." This was a kind of repartee that went on in momentous moments during the invasion of Europe, day two. And we pulled away after all these guys, who I thought at least deserved to go back to this country, our country, and be rearmed, fed, and sent ashore in a proper manner. Not a bit of it. To my knowledge, they went ashore completely bare of any weapon. In fact,
how did you get them off?
By landing craft. Landing craft came alongside. But there's another interesting twist to this story, which is that the one thing that I became aware of, well, the two things that I became aware of when they went ashore, one is that they left lots of gear aboard our ship. The second thing was that they went ashore festooned with French letters. I don't know quite how they were aiming to win the war in that way, but nonetheless, they were taking precautions. I think they were used often to cover up their watches and their money, money that they possibly won in poker games on the way to the beaches. However, we were left with a legacy of life belts. One guy went ashore without his boots, and we had these condom packs. They weren't called that in those days, literally French letters. And we blew them up in the Christmas of 1944 to decorate the ship, because they were still hanging around. They were not used, as far as I know, by many aboard our ship.
Anything else happened that day off of Omaha? What's the next thing you remember?
Well, we turned round and returned back to Plymouth. And on the way, we found that Narborough had been quite severely damaged by the press of escaping survivors from the Susan B. Anthony. One of the Ehrlichans was useless. The ship's guardrails had been broken down. Some of the other bits and pieces around the ship had simply been broken by the press of people. It wasn't willful damage. There was no vandalism of that kind. It was simply that we were not seaworthy afterwards. And of course, we found also, when we got back to Plymouth, that many of the ships that I'd seen, the destroyers, the American destroyers in particular, looking rather shabby, had got bent guns. Their main armament had actually melted or bent under the firing of shells, which I suppose was a bit of gung-ho in our mind, but nonetheless, there was quite a lot of damage occasioned by the friendly fire. In addition, I found out later that most of our damage going to and fro, we actually did 35 trips to France in all, most of our damage was done not by the enemy but by our own vessels. There was more danger from things like Liberty ships, caissons, debris, and on quite a number of occasions we were damaged. So that we went back to Plymouth to be repaired, ready for the next convoy. And for the summer, much of the summer, June and into July, we were ferrying convoys. Sometimes we were sent to Portsmouth, but more often than not, it was from Plymouth or from ports along the south coast. I remember one time going to Portland and picking up landing craft there. The whole of the south coast was, after all, an armed camp, and we were supplying the ships with troops, weapons, machinery, tanks, lorries, and we had to escort them across. The landing craft were sometimes landing craft tank, landing craft infantry, or often, or very occasionally, very small landing craft, the assault craft, which were still used for this. They didn't take many across to France.
So you were on this June, July. Were you ever attacked? Or was it more a risk from your own side, as you're saying?
We were not, to my knowledge, attacked until later on in the year. But what we did, and this again is something of dispute, we sailed along with three other of our class to Spain in mid-July 1944. Now the records say that this was July 1945. Narborough, when it went to Spain, was in the American camouflage. I have a photograph taken in Spain. I have also a little souvenir from Spain, which I put on the date at the time. Of course, no one can verify this. Las Arenas, Bilbao, Vizcaya, 1944. 20 fotografías. And these photographs are typical tourist photographs.
So tell me about this trip to Spain then. What was this about?
We sailed from Plymouth at high speed into a gale. And soon, I think from Plymouth, we actually went to Falmouth and left Falmouth in the gale, probably to take on more stores or possibly take on personnel. We sailed at high speed, which was at that time not our fastest speed by any means, but 20 knots. And three of us, we were three captain-class frigate sailing to France, then past the outer part of Ushant to northern Spain. And we were going to pick up vessels that had been interned by Spain. I said, well, at this stage, Spain reckons we're going to win the war, so there's not much point in holding on to these vessels. How it had come about, I have no idea, but we went to the outport for Bilbao and anchored off Las Arenas, which was, the port was La Guadalupe. I hope I've pronounced it correctly, but Bilbao was the major town in the area, which had a lot of British connections. The ships that were there were not sailed for some time, and they were repaired and made seaworthy by our staff. We also took a skeleton crew, and they were rather shattered by the speed at which we went through the gale. In fact, we had to slow down, otherwise the ship would have suffered damage. The other two vessels went to San Sebastian and Santander, and they did much the same job. Now, we were lucky, if you can call it lucky, because the ship that we were, one of the ships that we were meant to take back, had a flashback, which unfortunately burnt one of the merchant seamen, not too severely. He was not hospitalized, but nonetheless, that vessel was not fit to sail, and so we had an involuntary holiday in Spain in the summer of 1944.
July.
And we came back, possibly, at the beginning of August. Now,
that before... Was conflict with this that you ran into?
I had rather preempted...
George Cohen.
I rather preempted the next stage of our activities, because between the July and August, before going to Spain, we had taken part in the landings at Bordeaux, and the date of these can be actively can be verified. We were the only British ship to take part in this, and we sailed with the Free French. We sailed with the ancient battleship Lorraine, the heavy cruiser Duquesne, and the light cruiser La Galissonnière. We were part of an escort of frigates. These were mainly river class frigates of the Free French, and I remember the leader being a ship called La Surprise. Because they were French, we didn't have an awful lot to do in RT or code. Most of it was done by international code, which was done by flag. Obviously, we couldn't communicate. And our yeoman of flags, the yeoman Bunting Tosser and his henchmen, worked their socks off in the Nelsonian fashion, sending up signals and having to come in close to read, or if in emergency, to use the flasher. But the flash again was in international code, which didn't affect me. I wasn't able to use. I didn't know about international code, but I was not required to use it. This was done by the signal.
Where are we going?
We're going to Bordeaux, and the landings at Bordeaux were relatively unopposed, and we turned tail and went back independently. Went back to Falmouth and carried on where I rather preempted where I came in too soon because of the...
Well, you've also got this... You were rammed by the SS George M. Cohen in July as well. And
it says that was anchored. We were at anchor off one of the beaches. I can't even remember which one now, but it might not have been at Omaha this time. And we were there where the Mulberries were being built also. And from time to time, ships... would steer, we would be at anchor, ships would cut across our bows and blunder into us, perhaps because they didn't realize that the amount of way they caused created a vacuum between them and us. And I remember seeing one of the Mulberries coming straight for us. Fortunately, the skipper on both occasions was summoned rapidly, or was actually having a snooze on the bridge, and quickly sprang into action, ordered full speed astern. We dragged our anchor, and in the case of the Cohen, the bows were just nipped a bit. But the Mulberry missed us by a whisker, simply because a tug had gone straight ahead and then turned to starboard. And, of course, the Mulberry followed at an angle and would have hit us amidships, but for the skipper's prompt action. So he saved. By the way, our skipper got Oakleaves for his helping with the rescue of the Susan B. Anthony.
How much damage was done by the Cohen?
Not a lot, although it was made us unseaworthy. We were not in danger of sinking or anything of this kind, so we just simply went back to Plymouth, went into dry dock, and were repaired. Again, it was not a serious damage. Other things that happened from time to time were minor damages, which often occasioned a little bit of apprehension, such as one of the glands in the screws bent simply under either metal fatigue or heavy seas at some stage, and we began to clatter, whereupon that had to be replaced, which meant we had to hove to, which meant that we were easy prey for any marauding U-boat. At this stage, we went to action stations and were ready to do whatever we could, but we were then immobile, stationary. And I remember the engineer officer, who was also a lieutenant commander, having to don his overalls and get fully greased up in the stern where our mess had once been. These events are somewhat jumbled, but all this came in a very busy time when obviously it was announced at the end of 1 year we'd steamed by the skipper that we'd steamed 55,000 sea miles and had been at sea in some way or another for over 300 days.
Now, that's a bit of a jump, though.
That's a bit of a jump.
Now, so the next thing is, you seem to be... What happened in August?
We went... In August, we, again, were drafted in to escort a battleship. This was the Ramillies. Again, an ancient battleship. Not quite as old as the Lorraine, but nonetheless, we escorted the Ramillies south for the invasion in the Mediterranean of France. This was the August invasion. I can't remember its code name now. We didn't go beyond Lisbon. We were met by the Dover flotilla, the Gibraltar flotilla, who took charge of Ramillies from there on. And we turned round and came back again. Back to Plymouth.
What else in August? Or is the next thing into September?
No.
So you joined the 15th Escort Group then, from the looks of things.
Well,
what's the next thing you...
I'm remember? A little hazy about 15th Escort Group, because I had it that we joined 15th Escort Group long before then, because it can be checked, I am sure, that the ships that went to Santander in July were members of the 15th Escort Group. Santander and San Sebastian, they were members of the 15th Escort Group. We went, by this time, we were moving further east up the channel, so we tended to go more from Portsmouth than from Plymouth, and we were escorting across to northern France, and it can be verified with the progress of the land war, where the ports were being opened up, such as Antwerp. And for that purpose, at Portsmouth, we were fitted with a pom-pom, a 40mm cannon on the forepeak. And one of our seamen, who was a gunnery expert and pretty good at firing this thing, had to sit up there in often quite rough weather, bouncing up and down more than anyone else. And on one occasion, we had a skirmish, that's all we can describe it, with E-boats. There was very little firing going on, but nonetheless, we loosed off a few rounds of pom-pom and a little of the main armament, but that was all. This sheared off and been on convoy duty. We didn't normally go chasing after them. Also, when I was in that area, I actually saw a buzz bomb going across to London, which was quite a horrendous sight. There are many other events, obviously, which come in a jumble and cannot necessarily be verified chronologically by me or by anyone else. But nonetheless, it was a time of going ashore, perhaps for one night. And I remember going ashore at Portsmouth when we went round, coming back to Narborough, the entire, what seemed to be the entire fleet. It took about 2 hours from the jetties in Portsmouth to get out into the Spithead, or even the Solent, by means of what we call the trot boat.